Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling.
I'm Jenny Brentas.
And I'm Connor Orr.
And guys, this is a show for reflection. We are halfway through the season, and in a real beautiful piece of scheduling with the 18th week that we all just love here, we are at the literal halfway point. We are 136 games into a 272-game season, and that excites me ever so slightly as we unveil our mid-season report. We're gonna redo some of our picks. We're also going to revisit some of our only good takes from the preseason, because we only had good takes.
That's the situational editing that we've come to love and expect from producer Shelby, where like you can say so much dumb stuff, and then if you only bring back the good stuff, then it just makes you compounding over years and years seem smarter and smarter.
This is how you enhance the reputation of the Oracle.
Hey, by the way, Gary and I did our foray into SI sports gambling, and I nailed the over-under on the Bears Steelers to the number 56.
Yes, to be clear, I said if you're going to bet on this game, bet the over. But yes. Connor predicted the exact total that would end up coming out of that game.
Nothing could be wrong with a skill set that would lead people gambling on sports for a living to trust you with their money in a desperate situation. I find no high risk involved in this at all.
That's pretty amazing, though, Connor. I feel stronger and stronger about the Oracle by the day.
Well, listen, between selective editing and sort of cherry picking our favorite moments, we are just going to create a certain level of delusion that I think we can all get behind at this point. But we are going to start with a broader conversation about what surprised us in the first half of the season. So I'm gonna open the floor here, Jenny or Connor, either of you can buzz in and go.
I'll go first, Gary. My biggest surprise of the first half of the season is the 2-7 Miami Dolphins. They have the same record now as they did at this point in the season in 2019, which was supposed to be their teardown season. It really seemed like things were headed in the right direction last year. They were 10-6. They were in the playoffs mix. Seemed like they were even potentially ahead of schedule. And then this year has just been a really big disappointment. Tua Tagovailoa has missed time due to two different injuries, and certainly his development hasn't been helped by either, you know, the inability of the team to find the right offensive coordinator, and also especially the team's not so secretive pursuit of Deshaun Watson, and the fact that owner Stephen Ross basically had everyone else in the organization answer questions about it, particularly Flores and Tua himself. So it seemed like they were, you know, on a good path, and there was a clear path forward, that it was a good combination between Brian Flores and Chris Greer, and they were proceeding as they had drawn things up. And this year has really just muddied that path forward, and I'm not quite sure where they go from here.
And what's weird about it too is, like you said, what happens, because, you know, the Browns, when they came out of their teardown, Hugh Jackson was kind of given some sort of assurance, right, that he would be able to see it to the other side. But the other side was so bad that they immediately fired him in the middle of the season and then went with an interim coach until they could get a more, find a more permanent solution, whatever you want to call it. But what's weird about the Dolphins is, you know, this whole mess is sort of, you know, a personnel issue. It's an ownership issue. Brian Flores got them to 10 wins a year ago. You know, do you punish him because your owner is meddling in the quarterback position? Do you punish him because the free agent splurge that was spearheaded by the general manager hasn't worked out? And do you potentially let go of a really good head coach just because, you know, some other things are going wrong? You know, it's weird because owners can't fire themselves, even though we wish they might sometimes. But what is the other course of action? Because, you know, he's going to have to do something in order to, you know, sort of make somebody be held accountable for this.
if Stephen Ross was really a man of his word at this point, he'd let Brian Flores and Chris Greer keep going. This was a plan that he signed off on and embraced when they wanted to tear the whole thing down. And, I think the quote was, when they moved on from Adam Gase, it was because, Adam Gase, I'm paraphrasing here, wants to try and make the playoffs. And they weren't interested in that. They wanted to go get their quarterback. They wanted to do the full reset. So this is what they're doing, and it turns ugly sometimes. You saw it turn ugly in Cleveland, and now they're coming out of it. And it's ugly in Miami right now. As far as this season goes, the offensive line has been hugely problematic. The quarterback has been problematic. The defense has not played as well. I think you were going to circle one thing and say you could kind of put this on Brian Flores. I think it's the defensive performance to this point. But at the same time, the Dolphins were just sort of in that group. There's always that group of like team 10 through team 25. And it's like, if things break well, 10 or 11 wins. And if things go as badly as they could, 4 or 5 wins, and they kind of just fell to the bottom of that pit after maybe catching a few breaks and being in playoff contention a year ago when they weren't quite ready for it.
And it's, what it reminds me of, when the 49ers promised one of the brightest coaching stars in recent NFL history, Chip Kelly, a chance to do a full rebuild in San Francisco, and then pulled the plug after a year and then let somebody else do the full rebuild. Like, that's what, if I'm Brian Flores, I'm constantly worried about that, because I think a lot about, not necessarily Chip Kelly. I love Chip Kelly, but I'm the only person. I just like to bring him up from time to time. But Hugh Jackson and all these other guys that get through the thunderstorm, get you through the worst of it, and they stand up there and they become associated in the public eye with losing. Those are the guys that, they run the risk of just being a casualty of the situation. And to your point, Flores, that's right. That was one of the things he did wrong. Another thing that he can take the blame for is an inability to find an offensive coordinator that can do anything to kind of expedite Tua Tagovailoa's situation, even though Gary is anti Tua Tagovailoa. But I think while there is blame to go around, I think it would be ridiculous to get rid of Brian Flores, but I do think something needs to change.
And I think this was a path that the owner was really behind. He was sick of being mediocre. He wanted to break out of that purgatory. So he said, okay, I'm going to fire Adam Gase and I'm going to change things at the quarterback position, move on from Ryan Tannehill, and we're just going to totally restart. I really don't know if this approach works in the NFL. We haven't seen a great proof of concept, and the Dolphins were sort of supposed to be an answer to, can this be a sustainable strategy in the NFL? But, I think a lot in contrast, the Buffalo Bills, and they never did that. And they were one of the better teams in the AFC. We would have said potentially the best team before last week's oops to the Jaguars, but they've been 6 wins or more since 2011. They were always kind of in that middle ground, middle of the pack for a draft pick. It was hard to maybe get a quarterback, but you know what? They found a way to get a quarterback. They found a way to turn around the organization without hitting rock bottom. And I feel like we need to talk a little bit more about the teams that have been able to turn things around by doing that strategy versus the extreme rebuild or gutting or whatever word you want to use that puts a lot of strain on the people who are there for it and also out in front, right? The faces who are representing whatever this period is.
All right, Connor, what is your first half of the season surprise?
I have to go. I have a big apology to make to the people of Cincinnati, to all Bengals Nation. Every year I took it over from beloved former colleague Jonathan Jones, but predicting every single game of the season, our editor Mitch just actually reminded me right before we started taping over Slack that I thought I gave the Bengals 5 wins before the season. I gave the Bengals 3 wins for this season. They have already almost doubled that total. Are in the conversation for the playoffs. I don't think they'll get there. I think they'll kind of fall behind a little bit over the second half of the season, but I totally underestimated Zach Taylor. I totally underestimated their defensive staff, and I totally underestimated Duke Tobin and their targeted ads in free agency. I totally underestimated Ja'Marr Chase. To give myself a tiny little pat on the back, like maybe a pinky finger to make myself feel a little better, I did say the offseason narrative that he couldn't catch was ridiculous, and I'll give myself that. But this is a good team. I mean, this is a classic middle era Marvin Lewis Bengals team that, regardless of whether they're going to make the playoffs or not, they're going to be really annoying to play. They're going to be dotted with talented players. And it's weird to say this, but I would say, Jesse Bates is not playing as well as he has in previous seasons, but he came into the season as arguably one of the two or three best safeties in the NFL. DJ Reader is playing as one of the four or five best defensive tackles in the NFL. And you have Ja'Marr Chase in line potentially for a rookie of the year bid. And you have three good to great offensive linemen, which, like, who the hell thought that was going to happen? You know, so that there's that you got to hand it to this coaching staff. They had a vision that we really couldn't see from 30,000 feet. And we, as in me, I don't want to lump anybody else in here with me.
No, I also underestimated the immediate impact that Ja'Marr Chase would have in this offense. It's really been transformative. And I was with you, Connor. I thought they should have gone offensive line, but clearly they knew that Chase was this can't miss prospect. And what we're seeing now is far beyond what you normally see between a quarterback and a rookie receiver, because Burrow and Chase have played together before, because they had that college experience. And obviously that made Chase even more valuable to the Bengals, that you could drop him into the offense. I mean, certainly he still had to learn your scheme and your calls and the routes you want him to run, but the chemistry that makes some of the most phenomenal plays in the NFL between a quarterback and a receiver, you know, you think of Aaron Rodgers and Devontae Adams, or Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce. Burrow and Chase already have that together, and that's really shown up and in Chase's ability to contribute well beyond what you'd expect from a rookie receiver. And together, that's elevated both the offense and the Bengals.
Well, I do want to let the three of us off the hook just a little bit, because I think we all kind of liked, or at least respected, the direction in which the roster was going overall, even if you disagreed with the Chase versus Sewell pick there. I agreed with it only because I thought it was appeasing Joe Burrow, and you want to make your quarterback happy before he maybe, starts looking around, thinking about playing somewhere else. But Joe Burrow has come back faster than we thought. The offensive line has come together much more quickly than we thought. That Jets loss, it's just going to sting so much as the season goes on, because this defense has not really had issues tackling. And all of a sudden, that Jets game, they didn't tackle. And that's how you go on the road and lose a game to an NFL opponent, even if it's not a particularly good opponent. But yeah, I think maybe they're just a year earlier than any of us rightly expected.
Well, I appreciate you trying to get me off the hook, but I hated the direction that the roster was going. I thought it was, for real. I mean, especially in the, when you go out and you sign like Trey Hendrickson, who to me, coming into that season, was the definition of a role player that benefited from a phenomenal environment, right? You had guys like Sheldon Rankins and Cam Jordan and all these other people opening holes for you. You were singled up a lot. And I thought, there's no way that this guy is going to be an impact player on another roster. I was wrong. He's playing really well this season. I thought that, for example, like Riley Reiff, you're picking him over Penei Sewell, and you're potentially losing out on a Hall of Fame caliber tackle in exchange for basically the definition of replacement level plus. But Riley Reiff is having a great season. He's having a really good season, and I think they've opened my eyes certainly to some different possibilities there. Where it's like, hey, we don't need to. If you have a good quarterback, you don't need to do what the Cowboys did from like 2010 to 2020. 15. You know what I mean? And that seems like sort of the expectation and the blueprint in all of our minds, where you just load up this team with blue blood offensive linemen at every position and you secure that and then you build forward, where, you know, a lot of these teams are just getting smarter and they're saying, hey, you know what, he could still play. And, you know, having him there is way better than, you know, a rookie tackle that's going to take maybe 2 or 3 years to get there. And, you know, the other part of it was, too, I did not expect them to be able to cut through the fat of that receiver evaluation process. I know we've brought that up before, but I think it bears repeating that, like, this is a really hard position to project to the NFL level. Arguably the most difficult, I think, because college offenses are so simplified that really you're just going off your own eyes, right? You're going off of what you think that these players are seeing on the field and then what they're prepared by their agents to tell you that they're thinking on the field. You don't know what's happening until you actually get them there or you get them on the board and you're able to work them out. And you weren't really able to do that because of the pandemic and coronavirus. So I just think it's an amazing job. So I will say, you know, in the Carolina keep pounding voice, but instead of keep pounding, Duke Tobin. It's all about Duke Tobin. Duke Tobin.
Oh, you know, you wrapped that up really nicely. I was upset. I offered you a helping hand. I tried to help you up off the floor, and you said, I'm just going to stay here and wallow in my own filth and my own wrongness, and I respect that. And you finished strong, so now I really respect it.
As my 8th grade reading teacher, Mrs. Smith, would say, poor decisions on my part should not constitute an emergency on yours. So, there you go.
So I'm going to unveil my surprise of the first half, and this is actually more of a surprise of the first 11 months of the 2021 calendar year. I'm gonna roll this back a little bit. I floated this trial balloon off air a couple of times. There is somewhere in the SI.com IT drawer of saved emails, wherever that gets stored electronically, a version of my preseason predictions in which I have the Jaguars in the number 7 seed in the AFC. And my theory has always been, I think there's a reaction when older coaches get hired or rehired. In this case, it was Urban Meyer getting hired in the NFL for the first time, where people say, oh, well, he's just going to think he can run this like a college program and all this stuff. And it's like, of course he doesn't. I mean, come on, guys. He's not taking this job thinking he's going to run it the same way he did a bunch of like 19-year-old kids. And boy, yeah, I mean, there's also supposed to be like a guardrail for the organization to be like, oh, by the way, you're not going to run this like it's a bunch of 19-year-old kids, right? And then he says no, and that's like your vetting process. But apparently none of that happened, and he just came in and tried to run it like a college program. So, look, I am absolutely adamant, and I will go down with this take if it goes badly over the next couple of years. I absolutely do think Trevor Lawrence is a generational prospect. I think he is in the same class as whoever you want to put up there. You know, Andrew Luck was probably the easiest evaluation, but I do think in 3 or 4 years, we will be talking about Trevor Lawrence in the same conversation as the top quarterbacks in the league. You know, probably whatever, Mahomes, Lamar, Allen at that point. But it's just stunning to me that you can get that piece in there and you can get a roster that it's not a good roster, but it's got NFL pieces. You went shopping in free agency. You added some pieces to shore up that defense. And I just can't believe how non-competitive they've been, save for beating the Dolphins in London. And then, of course, sort of outlasting the Bills at home last week.
You know what I think happens, Gary? I think an organization makes what they consider to be a splash hire, a big name college coach. And I think the college coach comes in there, and as a person who was once on the recruiting trail in a lot of living rooms, is an excellent sweet talker to an older generation, and they just get sucked into whatever he's pitching. And you're right. The idea that you would run an NFL team the same way you would a college program is totally nonsensical. But from people who have been around Urban Meyer, my understanding is, you know, he talks really well, talks a good game, can get people around to his way of thinking, at least for the moment. And so then maybe leadership of the organization is like, oh man, yeah, this guy, he's really motivating me. I'm going to let him do what he wants without taking into account that that's not going to work in the locker room. At least that seems to be the case, because it is surprising that he wouldn't try to do things differently. It's surprising that he thinks playing NFL teams is like playing Alabama every week, and that he would say that out loud to another coaching peer in the NFL. All of these things don't make sense, but I think he basically was allowed to kind of run things the way that he wanted to run them, which comes from an arrogance that he's always had success doing it a certain way. And why should he have to change, without a recognition that you really do have to change? It's a totally different game, college versus the NFL. And clearly there wasn't a full understanding of that before he made the transition.
I think the one thing that could save, so I'm going to offer Gary an out here. I think the one thing that could save your original take, that Jacksonville Jaguars are obviously not making the playoffs this year, but they still have a game against the Texans left. They have a game against the Jets. They have a game against the 49ers, and who knows what the 49ers are going to be at this point. I mean, they might bottom out, and they have both of their games against the Colts. And I think that, I don't know, could they win three or four of those in a row? I mean, I think this is probably the worst case scenario for Jacksonville Jaguars fans and ownership as a whole, because I think they're going to finish the season better than they started it, which would indicate improvement, but is largely just how their schedule broke, right? They had an extremely fortunate schedule over the back half, and they have more bad opponents than good opponents. And, they also have Atlanta, they have New England, and I'm not saying that they could beat the Patriots, but I'm saying they might be able to steal one of those games and I think finish the season better than they started. But, I think it was certainly a surprise. Like, I think the entire approach that Urban Meyer took this year was a complete surprise. And had it not been for arguably one of the most chaotic weeks in NFL history, we would still be talking about why he is unfit to coach this football team. If the news cycle wasn't so easily distracted and out in space as it was, I mean, he would still be in the crosshairs.
I'm just saying, everyone else, I think, saw it coming, and I was probably the last one who did. It was. I had an email saved I was going to send off for my predictions that had the Jaguars in the playoffs, and it was, I don't know, the metaphor I'll give, it's like everyone looked at the roller coaster and was like, boy, that does not look safe. I'm not getting in that car. And I was like, I'll hop on in. And I was sitting there waiting for them to like pull the bar down. And right before it came down, it was like, nope, I'm hopping off. You guys were right.
Gary, were you secretly the shirtless person on Urban Meyer's boat? Was that you? Did he get to you before the season started somehow?
I forgot that was a thing. See, if I had remembered that, I never would have picked the Jaguars to make the playoffs, which I didn't. I technically did not. I technically avoided the fate of, I don't know, whatever, when that roller coaster cars just went, I don't know, flying into the ocean. Yeah, something like that. All right, guys. Next question. What are you most looking forward to seeing in the second half, or perhaps most intrigued about seeing in the second half of the season?
So I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball here. I think we have some of our predictions are going to be over on SI.com, which you guys can check out. I think I have something different there. But I'm going to go with, so this is a little bit sneaky here, I'm going to go with the New York Jets. I'm going to blow everyone's mind here. I'm looking forward to seeing the New York Jets over the second half of the season, and I have two reasons why. The first reason is that, and I think Florham Park right now is in uproar, right? That the Jets brought in John Beck, who is Zach Wilson's private quarterbacks coach, to be an assistant on the team. I actually think that's a phenomenal idea, contrary to probably previous history, right? And for those of you who love Friday Night Lights, the TV show, seems a little bit like when young hotshot freshman J.D. McCoy's personal quarterbacks coach ousted Coach Taylor and became the head coach of the team, and then Coach Taylor had to go to the bad side of town to coach the other Panthers, the Dillon Panthers, but they weren't the Dillon East or Dillon West, whatever it was. So it's got that vibe to it. But I would say that John Beck has been like a big name in quarterback coaching for like the last 5 years. He's had some of the biggest quarterbacks in the NFL. Kyle Shanahan personally sent the guy that he was going to draft to John Beck to have him evaluate him coming into the draft. And while you could say, well, Trey Lance isn't ready to play, is that an indictment of them? I don't think so. I think it's they're trying to win games right now. And I just think, you know, if your quarterback maybe just needs help in the translation process, what's the problem with that? You know, John Beck's going to have something to offer. Rob Calabrese, the quarterback's coach that it's there, is obviously doing a good job. Mike White had a good game. Josh Johnson was ready to play. And so I don't see a problem with adding some brain power there. They obviously had an awful tragedy at the quarterback coaching position to start the year. So why not try to bolster the room a little bit and give yourself a chance to have Zach Wilson finish strong? And I think the second part to that question, the prediction here is that, you know, the Jets still have both Dolphins games left. They have a Texans game. They have a Jaguars game and they have an Eagles game. They could win some or all of those games. You know, I think they could. And, you know, they could finish the season hot. If Zach Wilson could play the way he did against the Titans, you end the season on far higher of a note than you started the season with. And yes, you're going to have the Buccaneers, you're going to have the Bills twice, and you're going to have the Saints. So there's a chance to get those epic sort of Patriot-style beatdowns that we've seen earlier this year that almost kind of looked like that sort of FBS versus FCS team stuff. But I oddly think, like, if they can win the games that they're going to be competitive in, the teams in their talent tier, I think we're going to be coming into next season thinking, like, okay, like, this is fine. It's not a disaster.
All right, so you're all gas, no brakes on the Jets for the second half of 2021, Connor.
I've slid underneath my car and I've cut the brake line. I've removed the brakes. There is no stopping.
I think it's an interesting conversation about the quarterback coach. One thing that is true around the league is there can sometimes be an awkward dynamic between a personal quarterback coach and what the team's offensive staff wants the quarterback to do. I think in many cases, the best relationship is when veteran quarterbacks have their quarterbacks coach that they work with in the offseason on their mechanics specifically, and they're able to get those all tuned up. Then they go back to their team and they may visit the quarterback coach on the bye week or on a mini bye just to essentially be, you always hear Tom Brady talk about it, right? He's constantly tuning his mechanics. That's a big part of his success. But for a younger quarterback, those regular checkups or, you know, taking your car into the shop might not be enough. So maybe you need the personal quarterback coach to help you along more in the rookie season until you get to a point where you could do the regular checkups. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I hadn't thought about the fact that maybe it's not this big bad thing that it sounded like at first, Connor. So I like your perspective there.
But you make a good point. And I think that it's sort of, you know, it's filling in the gap that we all criticized Joe Douglas for not filling in at the beginning of the season, right? Because what did everybody say that Zach Wilson needed on that team that he didn't have? A veteran backup quarterback, right? And a veteran backup quarterback could see some of the things that a quarterback's coach couldn't. He could fill in some of the blanks that the quarterback's coach couldn't. And really, once you get into the meat of the season, the quarterback's coach is, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I have rarely heard of instances where a quarterback's coach is doing anything mechanical with you, right? He is essentially the offensive coordinator for the quarterback, right? He is scheme related to the quarterback specifically. And I feel like if you bring in Beck, it's sort of like, okay, here is a guy that's going to help you fix some of the sloppy mechanical stuff on the fly. He's going to help you with game preparation, you know, as a former NFL quarterback, not that far out of the game. And he can sort of translate some of the stuff that just doesn't seem to be sticking for Zach. Whereas, you know, I think if you just left it to its own devices, you brought in Joe Flacco for a 6th-round pick a couple of weeks ago, and you're hoping that he's going to turn things around for you from a veteran standpoint. And I just think this is probably insurance on the back end for a decision that you probably should have made a couple months ago. Now, if you had kept Josh McCown or, you know, brought in someone like that, I think you wouldn't need any of this, or Brian Fitzpatrick, whatever it is. But you've sort of put yourself in that situation.
I like that. I could see being very interested in a ticket to that bandwagon, Connor.
That's all I can ask.
Jenny, why don't you go ahead?
I'm pretty intrigued for the second half, Gary, to watch what happens with Baker Mayfield and the Browns. This was one of the major questions heading into the season. We saw the Bills extend Josh Allen, but the Browns and Baker Mayfield didn't reach a contract extension. So he's under contract with the team through 2022, the end of his rookie deal. What will happen? What will this season bring? How will this inform how the team moves forward? And I think we still need answers to that major question. About a week ago, the team is 4-4. Mayfield has an injury to his non-throwing shoulder. Odell Beckham is using surrogates to very publicly try to force his way out of Cleveland. It didn't look like things were heading in a great direction, but the organization handles the Beckham situation. They move on, and we see Mayfield have his best performance of the season and a really big win against the Bengals. I think we'll get to this a little later in the show, of course, with Connor. But it was a reminder of what the Browns team can be, what they want to look like this year. And if they continue that, or at least we'll see how they continue that, it may inform what the organization does with Mayfield moving forward, or it will inform it. I'm just interested to see which direction they go.
I'm going to steal a term from Connor Orr right here that I believe he coined, and I haven't seen anywhere else. We all kind of got used to that sort of contractual Jenga when it comes to the quarterbacks. Just whoever was going to get paid next was going to be the highest paid, whether you go back to the, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo or whoever it might be. The real interesting thing about Mayfield is I don't think there's any way you would put him in that stratosphere with the, you know, Mahomes contract or the Russell Wilson deal or any of that stuff. So they are going to have to come up with some sort of different solution. And does Baker sort of think he can maybe play his way into that stratosphere next season? Does he want to take something shorter and sort of go year to year and play like that? There are a lot of interesting ways this can play out, but I think we're also at a point in the quarterback market where there really aren't many great alternatives for Cleveland at this point. So I think he stays there. It's just a question of how long does he stay there and how ultra wealthy does he become in the short term?
Does he stay there, or does Kevin Stefanski reunite with Kirk Cousins? Or is Russell Wilson given a partial ownership share of the Browns to come and bring them to a Super Bowl? I don't know. But I think that the Browns are smart. I mean, this is an interesting front office setup where, you know, what if, you know, over the last few years, there have been certain football teams that have succeeded. Jenny did a great job of spotlighting the Ravens, for example, for seeing things that the rest of the NFL is not seeing. The Ravens, for example, capitalized on certainly a quarterback that nobody saw coming, but also little things like tight ends, you know, big kind of super back guys that could diversify your backfield and force the defense to do other things. Tight ends can be just as productive, but they cost half as much and they can block. They're way more valuable, infinitely more valuable in certain cases than wide receivers. But I think that the Browns could also be taking a different approach to this, right? I mean, obviously you need a franchise quarterback to succeed. I think Paul DePodesta would certainly, you know, admit that. But if you have the setup that you have, and you have the elite offensive line that you have, and you have the running backs that you have, and all these guys that are extended through a various point in time, do you start to view the quarterback position as a little less of a something that can get you over the edge and more of something that's like, you know what, we can probably just keep trying to stick guys in here because we have everything else the way that we need it, you know? And I could get Kirk Cousins in here and he could get us probably damn close to the Super Bowl too, and I don't need to pay him $45 million a year to leapfrog the rest of it. Like, I'm curious if their understanding of the market and their willingness to maybe find a similar inefficiency in the way that we view quarterbacks might lead to something really interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of a true test for, is their rebuilding strategy or team building strategy rather really all that different, or will it be more in line with what we see around the league?
All right, so my second half story that I'm watching, and I am very uncreatively sticking with the quarterback storylines here, but I want to know what the Saints are going to do here. They have a little bit of margin for error in the NFC. You know, they have a game lead on basically everyone chasing them here, a game and a half, I should say, for one of those wild card spots. But we know they have the defense. We know sort of 2 through 53 on that roster is really good. Lots of questions about Jameis Winston. I think even if Jameis Winston were still healthy, there would be lots of questions about him. And there are certainly just almost infinite questions about the prospect of Trevor Siemian being the guy who is supposed to take this really championship-ready rest of the roster deep into the playoffs. So, look, Sean Payton will forget more about football during this segment than I will ever know. So I don't want to be overly critical here, but we talked about this a little bit on the Monday show. It was just kind of head-scratching that Taysom Hill didn't get the start. And I keep on trying to sort of turn this around in my mind and try and figure out what might have gone into that decision. And look, some of it might have been he faced the Falcons twice last year. That is an offense that maybe doesn't have a whole lot of, surprises. Overall, it's a lot of misdirection-based stuff. Maybe you don't want to run it out a third time against the team and think you can hold off, but what they have with a roster that is very thin at receiver, now they have a quarterback who really does need to be lifted by the rest of the by the rest of the roster at this point. It just seems like Taysom Hill makes so much more sense, but he's just suddenly so reluctant to lean on his one time, I don't know, favorite guy in the world, it seemed like.
I like the idea of this really, Bob, like legitimately that it's constantly turning over in your mind. Like, you know, your kids are like, Dad, and you're like, hold on, I just can't, I don't understand why Taysom Hill's not in right now. You know, it's like, this is a big deal. But yeah, it's a weird moment for Sean Payton's legacy, right? Where on one hand, we should be appreciating what we're seeing at this moment, because, you know, not a lot of franchises can seamlessly handle the retirement of a franchise legend, especially a guy like Drew Brees, who, like Tom Brady, was so married to the scheme and helped create it and, you know, helped evolve it and into what it was. And so it is interesting, but that versus your inability to either have a young quarterback on the roster to one day replace him, or your unwillingness to go out and get like a Cam Newton who is still available and not playing. So I think the whole situation is really sort of fascinating, because on one hand, it does show how brilliant he is week in and week out. He's winning games with guys like Trevor Siemian and was winning games with Jameis Winston. And, you know, I maybe see Ian Book at some point this year, you know, the guy he drafted in the fourth round. But on the other hand, it's like, when your roster is this good, why wasn't there a little bit more of a thoughtfulness kind of put into this? And why are you abandoning a guy that you know that you could win games with?
Yeah, you have a defense that shut down both Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady this year. So you know that your team should be able to compete with anybody, but you have this question mark at the biggest position on the roster. Maybe it's an in-between period, sure, but as Gary referenced, they gave Taysom Hill a first-round tender, then they gave him a contract extension. They set him up as, you know, potentially being the guy. So I think following what the Saints do at the position to sort of make the most of this season and not let this season with this defense pass them by will be interesting. But regardless, it seems like they will for sure be in the quarterback market in 2022, and that will be interesting to watch as well.
Okay, it is now time for a trip down memory lane. We are going to look back at our favorite takes from the preseason, and I think we're starting with one of mine. I do want to make up a little bit for my very milquetoast picks on the last two categories and just throw out an outrageous take. Jeffrey Simms is not Aaron Donald. There's a bit of like an Aaron Donald vibe here as a guy who might rise to that level where he's really wrecking games, but things are still kind of a mess around him. So maybe the team defense is not quite where you want it to be. But yeah, I like that pick.
Gremlin: Jeffrey Simmons better than Aaron Donald. Interesting.
better than Aaron Donald in his prime. And as Jenny Rentis pointed out in her Weekly Tuesday column, Jeffrey Simmons does lead the league in quarterback pressures among interior defenders, one more than Aaron Donald at this point. But gosh, I was so young and just felt so good during that prediction there last summer. Just a different time in our lives. Felt good to remember it.
I sounded quite ill back then.
I was going to say, a little congested. Glad that you're feeling healthier now.
I don't sound like that all the time, right?
No.
Okay, good.
No, you have the usual like nasally high-pitched voice, but you also happen to have a summer cold at that point.
Don't get me wrong, your voice is super annoying, but it wasn't as bad as it was back then.
I do have to give Connor a nod because that conversation was set up by Connor picking Simmons as his best non-quarterback player in the AFC South. But this week, when we saw the Titans beat the Rams in Los Angeles, and it was a performance totally led by the defense, Simmons looked largely unblockable in the game. It was a great time for us to roll out this preseason prediction. And yes, as Gary referenced, Pro Football Focus has charted Jeffrey Simmons with 42 quarterback pressures for interior the most for an interior defender of the season, one more than Aaron Donald, who has 41.
Good for you, Gary.
Guys, get ready to remember some more, because I think Connor said something this summer.
So the Indianapolis Colts put together the wildest winning and losing streaks in NFL history. Frank Reich bolsters his credentials as a masterful coach by steering Indianapolis out of the doldrums following an intense, bad luck-laden losing streak of 5 games and steadying the Colts for a playoff run. Indianapolis' season is almost comically ping-ponged between unseen weather situations, injuries, doinked field goals, bounce passes, and other did-this-stadium-get-built-on-a-cursed-ground kind of happenings, including one very high-profile instance of food poisoning at a non-coastal restaurant where the idea of ordering seafood might seem iffy. Regardless, they emerge stronger and more dangerous than ever before. Michael Pittman Jr. reaches 1,000 yards, and the seafood poisoning at the non-coastal city becomes a rallying cry later in the year. Fans bring empty shrimp casings and clamshells to games and tape them to wooden signs. It bolsters their belief in the Midwest and in beef. After first downs, they chant, "Beef, beef, beef! We are Indiana, we are beef!" And it makes the whole community feel alive again, and families dine together at the table with their cell phones rotting in distant garbage cans never to return. They begin practicing mindfulness meditation at schools, and we all start to inch back towards the middle again, together. The Colts clinch the playoffs on a 76-yard punt return during the season finale.
Woo!
Oh, God. I hope that punt return happens so bad.
Also, Michael Pittman is on pace for a 1,000-yard season.
It's like, and the food poisoning thing, as we know, it happened to just an AFC South star, not a Colt. It happened to A.J. Brown, but I mean, you spent all summer just at the Ouija board, like letting the spirit sort of guide you as to what was going to go on, and just a couple of miscommunications there, but otherwise, that was really close.
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of like, you know, when Ben Franklin was first holding the key out to the kite in the lightning storm, it's like, you're gonna get lightning, but sometimes it's going to strike you in different areas in different ways. And so I think I heard food poisoning from the gods. I heard Michael Pittman. I heard, you know, all this stuff, beef, 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 and all that. So I will say that, you know, I still feel okay about this. I don't know if they're still set up to make a stirring comeback, I think, and potentially you know, turn things around. I think we're like one boneheaded Carson Wentz throw away from really changing the narrative on him this season. Like, I was really almost ready to write that sort. I think it was the Titans game, right? Where I think I was really ready to kind of write that Carson Wentz comeback narrative, and that this was a trade that worked and this all made sense and everything's going to be fine for the Colts. And so if you're, like Gary says, sample size, if we're one bad pick away from that, I think you could be one or two good touchdown throws away from reclaiming that narrative. And so, I don't know. I'm not ready to give up on the Colts yet, and I'm not ready to give up my belief in beef.
All right, guys. We have one more non-beef thing to remember.
Only in 2021 would this be considered against the grain, but I have picked the Patriots to win the AFC East. Maybe it is getting caught up in the recent Mac Jones hype and the rookie's strong preseason and him winning the job, or maybe it's the fact that this is the real start of the post-Tom Brady era in New England, or maybe I just think that we're all a little bit too down on the Patriots after one lone down season, and I don't really want to bet against their resurgence this year. So I have picked them to win the division.
Love that.
This is turning around quick, too. Had we done our original plan of a 35% of the way through the season show, I don't think we would have highlighted that. But now they're on a 3-game win streak, convincing wins over the Panthers, over the Chargers, even if the score was a little bit closer. They've won 4 of 5 here. The only loss was to the Cowboys in overtime. This feels like it's happening. This feels like they are legitimately like right there neck and neck with the Bills, ready for the stretch run.
Yeah, got off to a little bit of a rough start, I have to say. They were 1-3, looked like this pick was going to be way off. But I have to tell you, one of our colleagues, Jason Schwartz, a senior editor at Sports Illustrated, Massachusetts native, said that my pick gave him hope in the early stretch of the season that things would turn around, that, you know, maybe I saw something in this Patriots team. And yeah, they're a half game back of the Buffalo Bills, and they have 2 games against each other still to come.
I loved this pick from Jenny, and I think you can go back even a couple of shows, and even when they lost to the Buccaneers, and even when they lost to the Cowboys on that back-and-forth overtime game, we agreed on that. But I don't think that was a bad thing. That wasn't a damning thing for Bill Belichick. I think that was a sign that, holy crap, this team is hanging in there with some really good NFL teams. And Jenny brought this up a few weeks ago, and as critical as I was of Bill Belichick for not letting Mac Jones go for it on fourth down against the Buccaneers, I think Jenny nailed it. She was right. He was bringing Mac Jones along at the appropriate pace. He was ascending him on schedule, on time. And I think that because he had Tom Brady, we never really associated Bill Belichick's ability to groom a quarterback and never really thought about that kind of thing before. But I think he's done a masterful job with this. And they're right in the middle, in the thick of things.
So let's wrap up our midseason show with a revisiting of our Super Bowl picks from the preseason. And we'll open it up. If you want to change your pick at this point, you may. And we'll go with Jenny first.
Gary, I am sticking with my Super Bowl winner, the Los Angeles Rams, and my Super Bowl MVP, Matthew Stafford. There have been a couple setbacks for the Rams this season, but I still feel like their best is ahead of them this year. And things came together quickly with Matthew Stafford, but that doesn't mean there's not going to be hiccups along the way. I think the Titans loss was just kind of one of those weird games. As Gary likes to say, turnovers can really swing things, small sample size, yada, yada, yada. So sticking with the Rams as my Super Bowl pick, I am adjusting the AFC team that they're playing. I put the Ravens in there instead of the Chiefs, who I had in the preseason, and it's a wide open field in the AFC, but really like the Ravens and really think they're the best team in the AFC right now. And that's partly because they've continued to answer some of the questions about them. One of the big ones was, could they climb their way out of double-digit deficits? We've seen that be the nail in the coffin of seasons with them before because of the way they play football. You know, it's a run-based offense. It's not exactly what you envision when you come back. Well, they've changed that narrative too. They've crawled out of 3 double-digit deficits and turned those into victories this year. And so I like them to go to the Super Bowl, but still picking the Rams over them.
So I'll go next. I am going to be a coward and give 3 separate picks here. I'm fine with my preseason pick of Chiefs over Rams. I am still a believer that the Chiefs are just they're close. The defense is improving, as we've seen. I don't think they're that far away offensively from recapturing something. It's a reasonable facsimile of what they've been over the last couple of years. But I did, and this is my favorite part of the year. It's like Christmas and Halloween and Thanksgiving and Arbor Day all like rolled into one. I built my spreadsheet, my small sample size spreadsheet, in which I attempt to mitigate all what I consider the luck factors that go into every game here. The one thing I haven't built into it yet is strength of schedule, but that's a project for another time. But my spreadsheet tells me, based on the first half of the season, if you mitigate the luck factors, the two best teams in football have been the Dallas Cowboys and the Buffalo Bills. However, if I were going to change my pick, I am going with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers over the Cleveland Browns in the Super Bowl. Those are actually teams 3-4 on the godlike spreadsheet that I have built over hours and hours of time. And I'm going to give those teams a little bit of a bump artificially after building in all these numbers. I'm just going to make a subjective judgment and say, the absence of Antonio Brown in both of the Bucs losses factors in, and the fact that the Browns went without both tackles for a little while and Baker Mayfield briefly played with one arm only factors into that as well. So I'm going Bucs over Browns as my official Super Bowl prediction, so I can predict as many things as possible, and maybe one will be right.
Wow, you're even more of a hedge you're better than Connor Orr.
Yeah, I find this wholly unacceptable. Curious that this wasn't brought up at all during the pre-show. You've not given Jenny and I the proper amount of time to criticize you. I
would say I'm as equally aghast at this as your selection of Michael Badgley as an X Factor. So, in case my face isn't conveying that, I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah, it's beyond a thing that's like, oh, okay, you know, here we go again. It's like I feel a little aggravated, like it actual real beyond like, you know, like we're friends having a good time talking about sports. Like I'm going to have dinner and I'm going to be like, you know what, that pissed me off a little bit today, you know? So that's kind of where I'm at, you know?
Some people just can't handle the power of the spreadsheet.
All right, so I guess I'll go last. Every loyal listener to this podcast knows that I've been extremely straightforward and have not wavered one bit about my Super Bowl prediction throughout the year. Gary, now I feel like sort of stepping over the line by picking the Browns in the Super Bowl because, as our wonderful producer Shelby has already called up, I have a clip. I'm Jimmy Fallon now. Let's roll the clip. This Browns team is loaded, as Jenny said earlier. They have a coach of the year. They have Bill Callahan, who a lot of people, you know, is probably next to your head coach, your offensive line coach, might be one of the most important people on your staff. And so they have a lot of really good things going for them. And it was, you know, it's just they're together with the GM and the, you know, like there's no infighting. It's just like, this team could win the Super Bowl. I think that they have as good a chance as anybody of going to the Super Bowl and winning it this year. Key word that I want you to focus on in there, was when I said could win the Super Bowl. So inferring that they're going to be in the game would be right along with that, that theoretically when you're in the game, you could win the game. But I am going to change the team that is going to beat the Browns in the Super Bowl. Originally, I had the Packers over the Browns for my official SI pick. I have changed that to the Rams over the Browns. But I would just like everybody to know that, unlike Gary, I have never once wavered on my relative belief of the Cleveland Browns' ability to make the Super Bowl.
Okay.
Not once.
All right, fair statement. I still consider myself as the person with the most integrity when it comes to making picks on this show, and I'm going to feel really comfortable in that spot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that out of the three of us, you know, Jenny's probably the one that can look herself in the mirror, you know, and not feel a certain kind of way. But Gary and I are working on it. You know, this is a process of self-discovery.
I think we should just embrace it. I might add a fourth prediction at this point.
Panthers. No, just kidding.
The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Vrentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Thanks, as always, to senior podcast producer Dan Bloom, who helps us shape this show every week. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.